Yeah, let's go. I want to start out season 3, episode 9 of Shoot Your Shot by actually talking about the New Orleans Pelicans because they've been defying every single person's expectations, including us. I think they've been doing a lot better than most people perceive them, especially after the All-Star break. This can be seen in their second overall net rating, dating all the way back to December 1st. However, the fourth net rating dating back to just after the All-Star break, and then their eighth in offense and sixth in defense, which wouldn't really like pop out at you from those figures given their roster, because they don't have like anyone outside of Herb Jones, which should be a first team all defensive NBA selection, like we're gonna get into later in the segment after this. However, I just needed to point out that with the exclusive, with the outside Herb Jones, everyone's like a maybe average defender on the roster. Zion's a sub-average defender because he exerts most of his energy on the offensive side, just like Brandon Ingram. He's like a baby, baby not Kawhi. He's a baby KD. So when you see them having the sixth defensive rating after the All-Star break, it kind of raises some eyebrows. And I believe it's because they work really good in unison as a unit. I think they're kind of like the Boston Celtics. They're always helping when it's a 4-on-5 advantage. Their rotations off ball are super quick, and they are very good on communicating at the defensive side of the ball. And obviously, they're anchored by Jonas Valanciunas, who, as a Raptors fan, I've had plenty of experience with. He's a very reliable big, and he will basically hold his own in the paint. And he's also starting to take some threes recently as well, which is kind of commendable for a person his size and someone who came into the league when a big man wasn't supposed to shoot. So, it's kind of very interesting and intriguing to look at how the New Orleans Pelicans, most of the analysts, including us, also said that they will essentially fall down to that like 9-10 seed after the All-Star break. However, they did the exact opposite. I think they went like 7-2 in their last 10, with the exception of their last few games. I know they fumbled those, but right after the All-Star break, they've been doing quite well. Zion's kind of found his footing offensively. He's kind of like been starting at like initiating his own offense a lot more rather than having plays set up for him. So he's essentially doing what Giannis does. He like basically dribbles the ball up the court and then takes you off the dribble inside, and nobody can stop it, even though everyone knows that he's going to end up besides the rim, because that's the type of player he is. His archetype of player and play style is someone who ends up at the rim. He's not a good shot by any means, and I think he'd rather swing it out to CJ McCollum, who's having a career year from three. He's their third leading scorer, averaging about 42 or 43% from 3-point land, which is absolutely insane. And then the fact that CJ McCollum, at the ripe age of 30, 31, had to basically regress himself as a role player or a glorified role player, like a Derek White, for example, is kind of unfathomable. It's weird to think about. Like, I've seen a lot of comments online saying the fact that CJ McCollum, who's a professional scorer alongside Damian Lillard when they were both in Oregon, now has to be a spot-up shooter because he has better players on his team. And I think everyone kind of just didn't look at the New Orleans Pelicans in that light. I think everyone kind of just sold them to the side and just thought that they weren't going to be the team that they currently are. But as of right now, they're fifth in the West and they pose a legitimate threat to a lot of the teams out there. And I think that all of this exterior noise is further motivating them to make a deeper playoff push, because every single analyst as of right now is anticipating that their maximum of first round exit. So I think they're kind of hearing all this noise and they have a lot to say about it. And yeah, it's just kind of very shocking because both you and me had them leaving that 1-6 spot in the playoffs and kind of regressing to that play-in picture. However, they've solidified themselves in fifth place, and I don't see them kind of trailing It's the other teams who we thought that we were going to end up in the fifth, sixth spot, like the Lakers and Warriors, who've been dropping games. And it looks like we're going to have a 9-10 matchup between the Lakers and Warriors, where one of them isn't even going to have a chance to have a chance to end up in the playoffs, which is ridiculous.
Also shows you how stacked the West is. The fact that, Curry and LeBron, who 8 years ago, 6 years ago even, were playing each other in the NBA Finals, is absolutely crazy. And the Warriors are less than 2 years removed from their last one. I think the thing that's interesting about the Pelicans is they're almost doing a 180 of what they did post All-Star break last year. Because last year, I think they were around that like six seed, maybe a seven seed. And they were looking pretty good, but then they went on like a 2-13, like 15 game stretch, and found themselves, barely made it to the play-in and then did nothing. I think they're a very pesky team because, you obviously have a little guy like Jose Alvarado, who's kind of buried on the bench, but like has his like little insanity runs. I think having Zion consistently on the court has been a new dimension for them that the Pelicans really haven't gotten to experience in full the last, 3 seasons. So I think that's an added dimension. And, the fact that, as you mentioned, they're one of the best defensive teams in the league, have the number two overall defense during the month of March, turning a guy like CJ Collum, who isn't an awful defender, but he's never been known for his defense. He's been known for kind of being your splash player on the offensive side of the ball, especially from three. The fact that he's like turning him into like a playable defender, really anchoring, a team like he did with the Blazers for so many years, it's very impressive. And I think the Pelicans definitely could make more of a run than we think. And I do think balanced teams that have both good offenses and defenses tend to go furthest in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think they're kind of taking that Sacramento Kings slash Denver Nuggets slash Boston Celtics play style to heart, where they're essentially just not focusing a lot on like isolation plays or plays where not everyone's touching the ball. Ball movement's key for them. I think they've kind of taken that play style to heart. Like Zion Williamson's averages are all career lows across the board, including field goal percentage, points per game. Everything is down except for his assists. His assists went up because, like I said, they're kind of starting him at that point of attack role where he's essentially just like playmaking a lot more and getting everyone else more involved. And then, as I foreshadowed a little bit earlier as well, like we're going to talk about in the next segment, I just want to shout out Herb Jones because he actually came out and said on the record that he's never been used to teams, and I quote, never guarding him before, end quote. Because why? Because he was shooting 32% from the three. And if he was just spotting up, teams were willing to live with that shot. However, after that, his first 2 seasons in the league, he's actually young, he's 25. So he's been in this is his third full season of the league, and he went from 33% to 43%. Talk about a 10% jump in efficiency. And get this, he's taking even more threes a game than he did in his first 2 seasons. So more volume and more efficiency. And those two typically don't coincide unless your last name is a Curry, So that's just insane. Like, I think that has to do a lot with their identity. I think they're moving the ball around a lot more, like I mentioned. Everyone's getting touches. That means everyone's even more inclined to play on the defensive end. And like we said, CJ McCollum, who's a professional bucket getter, has been relegated to a spot-up shooter, the third leading scorer on the team. And he's like smack dab in the middle of his prime. So when you have two players like Brandon Ingram, who's essentially, like we said, a baby KD, can pull up, rise up from anywhere, get a shot, and it's pure. Or Zion Williamson, who's essentially a freight train heading to the rim, 6'6 at like 285. That's like never been heard before. Usually, if you're 6'6, you're like within the 225-pound range, like for example, Jaylen Brown or someone like that. And like Jaylen's like the farthest from like skin and bones. He's very, very muscular. And add like 50 pounds, and then you'll get Zion Williamson. So he's essentially created in a lab to just bully his way or bulldoze his way to the rim every single time. And like we said, their coach kind of came up with this tactic where he's getting him to initiate the offense a lot more, which is resulting in a lot more open looks because he's getting past his defender and then he can also finish in front of the center that's in front of him. So them giving him more difficult looks is allowing Herb Jones, for example, or Jose Alvarado, whoever's out on the floor, or CJ McCollum, those are all 40 plus 3 point percent shooters. So everyone counted them out, including myself, including you. And unfortunately, I think from a fan's perspective, we're going to end up having the bigger teams that we wanted to see in the playoffs end up in that, yes, 8 to 10 spot. We have the Suns already after losing today's game, down in seventh. We have Sacramento, who beat LA, which that was a pivotal game for them, also up in sixth. And the game's back margin is just unfortunately increasing with the games decreasing left. And speaking of Sacramento, I don't want to get into like their style of play. I want more want to mention their schedule because it's essential to look at the fact that they're literally playing the Mavericks twice back to back on the 26th and the 29th. And those two games will have massive seeding implications, not only because the Mavericks or Kings might go up or down a spot, but they're also going to affect each other's records because they play each other twice back to back. So if the Mavs manage to get the better end of the Sacramento Kings, and if they win tonight against Oklahoma, which it's a pretty close game, it's 63-65 at halftime right now as of this recording. The Mavs still might have an opportunity to get upwards to that sixth, fifth seed. However, at this point in time, I don't think the Lakers or the Warriors have the ability to leave the play-in tournament. It's just not looking good for them. The Lakers have one of the tougher schedules remaining. They're playing the Bucks, the Cavs, the Timberwolves, a lot more for the rest of the season. And they also have a game against the Warriors as well. That's make that two games against the Warriors. So just like we mentioned with Dallas and Sacramento, Lakers and Warriors are going to have a really important stretch down the rest of the season where they play each other twice. And I don't know, man. It's going to be a tough few games for them because it's going to affect each other's standings twice. And I just don't know if the Lakers have that dog in them to beat such a fast-paced team that's always shooting all over the court. And that be that as it may, I'm not sure if Steph Curry will be back for the next game against LA on Saturday, I believe. So if he's back, then obviously that's a much larger percentage chance of them winning. However, it's just sad. You don't want to see Steph Curry go out like that. You don't want to see him not even participate in the playoffs. Him getting injured with an ankle injury this late in the season is just not giving the Warriors any sort of break. Klay Thompson's like breaking way more often than we're used to seeing him play. So it's just kind of sad from a fan's perspective seeing those three teams be that far down in the playoffs. And it just kind of goes back to that play style aspect I was mentioning. Like you got teams like New Orleans and Sacramento. Sacramento's like kind of the gold standard of this example where they're essentially like playing through Sabonis a lot more than like their star guard or whatever the case may be. And don't take anything away from De'Aaron Fox because when games are like super down to the wire, he's still ISOing, getting his smooth mid-range, his smooth operator in that in-between game, just like Shea. However, at the end of the day, they just run things a lot more team-oriented wise through Sabonis. They're always running plays, dribble handoffs, screens, off-ball screens to get people open. And then that dribble penetration is always going to leave someone open. But as opposed to like the Suns or the Mavericks, for example, when Luka or KD is going to go up with that shot off the dribble penetration, they're not kicking it out as much, which makes their defenders not want to defend as much because they're not as involved on the offensive side of the ball. And then for the Phoenix Suns perspective, more specifically, it doesn't help when you have Royce O'Neal shooting like 1 of 17 in his last 18 three-point attempts. So I'm going to leave the rest to you. I just kind of wanted to talk about how this like lower play-in Western Conference picture from a fan's perspective, at least, is shaping up to be a little bit more depressing than optimistic because you have two of the biggest teams, including the Dallas Mavericks as a close third, with the Lakers and Warriors just ending up might not even make the playoffs to start off. So their playoffs is going to be a play-in to see if they can play in for another chance to actually get the playoffs, which is just sad from a pure fan's perspective. You can't see LeBron or Steph Curry go out like that.
I know, or like you even look at the Suns, like KD and Bradley Beal and Devin Booker, 7 seed Luka, who's in the running at the very least in the top two for the MVP race this season. You know, two of the 4 sets of those guys won't play in the playoffs at all. Like, you know, because even the 7 or 8 seed, they lose two, they're done. Like, they get no chance. I think it's just very interesting. I feel like in the West, there's almost this passing of the torch from the old to the young going on, because you have a team like the Timberwolves, you know, guys like Gobert and Cat are a little bit on the older side, but you know, you have Anthony Edwards leading the way, the Thunder, who just 2 years ago, the average age of their starters wouldn't have gotten them into a bar in the US because they were like 20 years old in like 8 months, but they managed to transform themselves into the second most balanced team in the NBA with top five both offensive and defensive rings, led by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, one of the most efficient and smooth bucket getters in this whole league. You know, the Pelicans are, you know, Ingram's a bit older, but you know, a newer team in terms of the guys playing together. CJ McCollum only came through last year. I think it's just very interesting watching kind of almost like the center of power, or just like talent kind of shift a bit in the West. Obviously, Steph and, you know, the Warriors, LeBron, AD, and the Lakers, you know, those guys are always going to be really good. But I guess like the flaws are a bit more magnified as the stars get older, and you have to depend on kind of your younger guys to help you out. You know, for the Lakers, sometimes LeBron has his like 1 for 8 from three type of nights. Still makes plays like nobody else can. Dude's definitely got eyes in the back of his head, but it's just very interesting how kind of the top teams in the West are shifting. Even the Nuggets, you know, last year won their first ever title on their first ever attempt in franchise history. So you're just seeing all these new teams rise, and you know, the LeBrons and Currys, like they're still getting a chance in the play-in tournament, but you're definitely seeing the West get a lot deeper, but also a lot younger. It's almost like a little bit of a new generation of basketball players, which, as you mentioned, as a fan, it hurts to see because guys like LeBron and Curry are generational talents. But their paths to playing in the finals every year, you know, that much harder now.
Absolutely. It's definitely a passing on of the torch, like you're saying. I think Luka, maybe Giannis is 29, so he's not that old. But definitely have the younger players like Luka, Shai, Ant-Man, Tyrese Halliburton, with the future faces of the league and the generational talents like we had, Steph Curry, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, just not on the same echelon as they used to be. It's that age catching up to them, like Russell Westbrook as well, for example. But yeah, this is not a depressing podcast, so we're gonna move on to the next point that we have. We touched on the Sacramento Kings a little bit, so it's kind of worth mentioning that in their matchup against the Lakers a couple of days ago, that single-handedly puts Sabonis, who is the biggest all-star snub in the history of the NBA, he's leading the league in rebounds. He's basically averaging a triple double. He has the most triple doubles and the most double doubles in the NBA this season. And he was snubbed, and his team was like sixth place when the selections were going out. And the team in like 12th, which was the Lakers, got two. Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm a Lakers fan, so that's coming from me. The Lakers lost to the Kings. Okay, and that individually puts Sabonis as 10 and 0 against Anthony Davis in his entire career, which is not worth mentioning because that's absolutely ridiculous. And that gave Sabonis 48 straight triple doubles. And he didn't make an all-star team this season, by the way, just so in case you guys didn't hear me the fourth time.
That's 48 double doubles in a row is just absolutely absurd. And I feel like with the Pelicans, I feel like the Kings aren't that like big market team. So they're kind of pushed to the side. And to be fair, the Kings offense isn't quite as firing on all cylinders, all gas, no brakes as last year. But Sabonis has really settled into his role very well on the Kings, really, as you mentioned, becoming the focal point of the team in terms of, scoring, playmaking. And then you also have one of the clutchest guys in the league and De'Aaron Fox on your team who can kind of score that crazy last minute bucket. He's had his crazy buzzer beaters before, so I feel like Sabonis, it was ridiculous that Sabonis didn't get selected to the All-Star game, even as a reserve. That's just that one was fat foul in my opinion.
Definitely.
I know all the guys who made it are very talented, but that one hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. It's also worth mentioning, piggying back off our last point, how LA only has, like, I think the 21st easiest schedule remaining in reverse. So that puts them in like the top 10 in easiest schedule remaining. Funnily enough, Boston does have the easiest schedule remaining in the entire NBA, and they don't need that at all. However, they do. But Golden State has the seventh easiest schedule remaining, and two of those games are against the Lakers, like I said. So that's going to have massive playoff implications, seeding wise, or play-in implications, shall I say. And yeah, it's kind of worth noting how the Lakers are essentially losing to like playoff teams that they're not going to face, however, beating playoff teams that they're more likely to face in the first, second round, at least, of the playoffs, because they're essentially losing to teams that move the ball around a lot, like I said, like the Warriors, Nuggets, Kings. However, when it comes to other teams that rely a lot on their stars, we see LeBron James at the ripe age of 40 and Anthony Davis at 31 getting the better of those matchups. Now, I think that's because D'Lo has been loading for like a quiet 27 years. He might have found his stride at the end. He's low-key been averaging 30 plus across his last few games, and he did have 44 points against the Bucks and 21 in the fourth quarter, which propelled them to an insane last-minute game winner by him. So, and then he obviously goes the next game and shoots 0 for 7. So, classic D'Lo. Maybe he's still loading. You never know. But at the same time, it's just worth mentioning that the Lakers are not going to be the same team when it comes playoff time. That's why I would give them the slight edge over the Warriors in that play-in picture as it currently looks. Because at the end of the day, they're also a much bigger team. And when it comes to rebounding, they're just going to get more second chance opportunities. Like we saw in the Suns Boston game today. If it wasn't for Nurkic, that game would have been a blowout after the first quarter. However, it was him that left the Suns into at the game, I think, until like halfway through the second. And then the Boston Celtics shot making just got ridiculous. Even having second chance opportunities didn't make up for it. But taking that and translating it onto the Lakers' perspective, it makes sense that the Lakers are going to be a much larger team to mess with come playoff time. And that's how they won their Mickey Mouse ring in 2020. But it's also worth talking about moving on from the Lakers and Warriors, because I feel like we spend way too much time on big market teams. We have to give Daniel Gafford, who's very young, I thought he was like 30, he's 25. Daniel Gafford almost broke the NBA record in consecutive field goals made across an X stretch of games with 33 consecutive field goals. And unfortunately, he missed his very first attempt today against the Thunder, which put him out of the race. Now he has to go again and have 36 in a row. But he beat Wilt Chamberlain's second all-time record, which was 32 consecutive field goals. And he came super close. He was two field goals shy of tying Wilt's still standing record of 35 consecutive field goals. However, that was in 1967 against people who were half his size. But that's neither the case here nor there. I think Gafford is a lot more seasoned and better than Derek Lively, which is a hot take for Mavs fans because Lively has been excellent this season. He's rated higher in 2K. However, I still end up playing with Daniel Gafford when I end up playing 2K with the Mavs because he's just a faster big. He's more reliable. He's going to get you more second chance opportunities. He's just as a big of a lob threat as Derek Lively. And at the end of the day, I just think he is more of a menace on the offensive glass. He's just like more experienced. So he's been in the league for longer. He knows his positioning a little bit better, but I feel like that's too specific to get into it. They're both really good bigs. And Dallas's last game before tonight, it was actually worth noting that those two bigs got 20 plus points each, and it was the battle of the bigs, which was quite rare where you'd find like two bigs getting 21 points each. And they both collectively only missed one shot, which Derek Lively did. So it's fair to say that that trade has helped the Mavericks a lot. And we'll see at the end of today's episode if they end up beating the current second seed in the Western Conference, because it is a hell of a close game with Luka sitting out, which will
About to
prove.
say.
Which will prove people like you who are doubters and say that Luka needs the whole team to function around him and all that argument astray, because at the end of the day, you have 35 points, 10 rebounds, and 9 assists sitting on the bench, and you're 2 points shy of the best team in the West. At least the best regular season team, because we all know when it comes to playoffs, that's a different story. However, so far, they are the best regular season team in the West. They've been in the top two the entire way from the beginning of the season, and they rely on their pace because they are not the best in terms of size when it comes to the five position and weight, especially. However, Chet Holmgren in any other season would have gotten Rookie of the Year, but unfortunately, he's going against a generational talent as well, which is essentially the next LeBron of the NBA in Victor Wembanyama. And Chet started out having higher percentages on less points, so he was the favorite. But after All-Star break, I think Victor's just been going too crazy. So at that point, when you have like a bunch of 5 by 5 games in your rookie season, I think that's an automatic clinch for Rookie of the Year because you're not supposed to do that. Like every other player who's done it was not a rookie. AD came close to doing it 2 games, 3 games ago, but he was 2 blocks shy. And Victor Wembanyama is just like a magnet on the defensive side. Did you know that when he sits, the Spurs defensive rating is DFL, as in dead effing last? And then when he comes back on the floor, it automatically rises to sixth in the entire league, just like that.
That's crazy how much of a difference it makes because the Spurs, everyone's just like, oh, they're 15 win team out of the playoffs already, but kind of misses the big picture of Wemby's having an incredible, especially post All-Star break rookie season. Also got that triple double with blocks, which is very crazy. I mean, I don't know the breakdown of like the usual 3 points, assists, rebounds versus finding a different way to get it, like from steals or blocks, but it's probably like 1% most where you're, getting something other than, the offensive triple double in a game. So it's very special. I also will say that based on what was it, 6 seasons ago, I'm very much opposed to a non-actual rookie getting Rookie of the Year, a la Ben Simmons getting it over Donovan Mitchell 6 years ago. But it's just absolutely crazy. I think the Thunder, though, have really used kind of their fast pace and a very efficient score in SGA. Lu Dort, Montreal native, also makes some run. Chet's great. They're a very balanced team. Jalen Williams the first, because there are two Jalen
Insane
Williams
pickup.
on the team.
Insane pickup.
And they're even getting, they kind of getting even more role players back too, who can help out. Gordon Hayward finally on a contending team. Guys like Isaiah Joe or.
Isaiah Joe, exactly. 40% are from the 3-point line.
Yeah, he's a guy who really can contribute off the bench sometimes as a one leading comebacks
A
for
lot of people
OKC.
argue that he should take the starting role over the one hated guy, the one hated guy on the OKC Thunder.
Well, it's so weird because Giddy is also like, won't, yeah, I know, don't want to say his name, but he's like far and away the biggest net negative out of that
Yeah,
starting
he's just
five.
a playmaker. Like he gets the ball to pass it back. When like anyone else can do that. Like you don't need to be him. But the main kind of concern with coaches when removing him is that the Thunder is already kind of like a small team, and he's the second tallest starter at 6'8". However, Isaiah Joe is like 6'4", 6'5". So, and like they're already playing Jalen Williams at the power forward position, and Jalen Williams is only 6'5". So when you have J Dub at your PF at like 6'5", and Giddy at your three at 6'8", if you sub out Giddy and put in another 6'5" player, then you're essentially starting like four players between 6'6" and 6'4", and then Chet. So like that's not like one of the better like taller front courts. Like how would they match up against Denver when Denver's front court is 3 6'10" dudes? You know?
Yeah, I think the size, because in terms of like second chance points, being able to grab boards, which has actually been probably OKC's biggest weakness this season by quite a bit.
Yeah, by
That's
far.
a real challenge come playoff time.
Yeah, they make up for that with their pace and like steals, deflections, all that good stuff, running back in transition. They're the number one team in the NBA off points in transition and points off turnovers. So that's how they kind of make up for it. But when the game slows down, like we've mentioned plenty of times, I think like their lack of size is going to end up hurting them. That's why a lot of analysts, including like Lakers head coaching staff and stuff like that, they haven't come out and said it verbatim. However, they'd obviously rather match up with a team like OKC in the first round because of their lack of experience, their lack of size, their lack of rebounding. So even if the Lakers slow down the game, miss a shot, they're going to get like two, three more chances at every time. Whereas OKC is only going to thrive in those like turnover situations or like fast breaks or stuff like that. And that's not to take away anything from Shai's half court game. He's like the second slash third in MVP voting as of right now. However, that's only one person. And then on the other side of the ball, his steals are good, but it still doesn't account for like what if LeBron James starts backing down J Dub, for example. J Dub's 6'5". He has a big wingspan, but he's not gonna stop like LeBron, which is essentially a freight train, still at 40 years old. So like those are the playoff implications of having that disgusting white man start in the PF role as opposed to like any other player on the roster. And a lot of people are actually coming out to say that they should start the other non-disgusting, beautiful white man in Gordon Hayward as opposed to the gross man who's a, I don't want to say on my podcast.
As a Celtics fan, I back it.
Yeah, like I don't know why they're
Love
not doing
Gordon.
that, you know? Like he has all the skill sets that Giddy has. He's the same height, he's more experienced, and he's gonna give them a lot of like that playoff experience feel. And like he's just gonna be like that like stable like role player for them that's never gonna go astray, you know? Like he was drafted ahead of Paul George, man. Like I don't know why people are like I know his career was derailed by injuries, especially that like initial Boston one, the first time he played for you guys. Like that was like one of the saddest moments in sports. Like they had to like the ref, like he it wasn't a timeout. The ref stopped the game because he saw his foot pointing the wrong way. And like he just started out, he was carried out on a stretcher, like he was tearing up. It was ridiculous. It was a super sad moment. However, that's
Gives me
another
nightmares as
take.
a Celtics fan.
Yeah, no, it's like but
It's
like now
awful.
he's back. He's not as good as he used to be, obviously, but I still think he deserves a starting nod over like that disgusting man's we've mentioned.
Well, it's also like, Gordon Hayward knows, when to make the right play. His,
Exactly.
shot selection is very solid. Like he takes very, don't want to call them easy shots, but very like safe shots,
Smart,
that
smart.
smart shots, you know, doesn't, he's not a huge gambler. His game is very smooth. That's the way I described it. And when, of course, before the injury, why I was so excited for him to join the Celtics, kind of being that stable playmaker, you know, kind of veteran presence. I think it's, as you mentioned, something the Thunder will really need come playoff time, because even those, you know, 7-8 seeds could really give them a hard time in the playoffs. You know, again, we mentioned that all the teams down there that are fighting for those two spots, they're all, you know, there's Luka again, at worst second in the MVP voting, possibly the favorite, you know, had like six triple doubles in a row recent, or excuse me, 30 point triple doubles in a
35 point
row.
triple doubles, yeah.
30, it was 35 points, even crazier. It'll be very interesting because, you know, as the game slows down too, one interesting element is that fourth quarter can be a make or break for teams. You know, one team that I want to talk about a little bit more when we come back for our break is the Phoenix Suns, who
For sure.
have a lot of talent. They have, you know, future Hall of Fame scorer in KD, who's won multiple rings, you know, multi-time MVP. But yet, despite all of this, the Phoenix Suns are far and away, not even close, the worst fourth quarter team in the NBA. As we'll talk about when we get back, they have the worst defense by a mile, or excuse me, the worst offense by a mile, and their defense like 24th
Not better.
net rating.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. More on that when we come back from our break.
Hey, Cat, sponsor us.
Yeah, so the Phoenix Suns have got to be one of the most wretched fourth quarter teams I have watched in quite a while. And that's so crazy because, as I mentioned, they have a generational talent, you know, one of the greatest scorers, if not the greatest scorer of all time, in Kevin Durant, you know, to complement Devin Booker, you know, also one of the better bucket getters in this league, with Bradley Beal, who is, you know, was quite plagued by injuries, especially the last 3 years with the Wizards, but went on the court, one of the best shooters, you know, was kind of the staple of the Wizards for so many years. You know, he's basically been playing more at the level of like a role player, though, really kind of settled into the back seat. So the Suns really, you know, between those three guys missing games, you know, they really just don't have it together, and they're not getting much help from others besides Nurkic, who had a 25-point rebound game recently, in which was in double figures in both offensive and defensive boards.
What about his 31 rebound game a few weeks
Oh, I
ago?
was thinking about that one actually. I think there was another game where he had 25 and like 10 offensive, deep 15 defensive. Even tonight he was 8 and 12 for 20 rebounds, which is,
He wasn't even that crazy in Portland. Like, he channeled his inner like rebounder when he moved to Phoenix.
and he's like borderline one of the few things that Phoenix is, or like one of the few guys like actually playing defense on Phoenix,
Yeah,
because they're
by
really
far.
struggling on that end. To break it down for you, the Phoenix Suns in the fourth quarter have a defensive rating of 117.9, good for 24th in the league, and an offensive rating of 103.6 per 100 possessions. 103.6. And you would be a little bit so, oh, almost forgot to mention, to bring us an overall net rating of minus 14.3. In 29th is the Miami Heat at minus 6.6. So it just really shows
Damn,
you
that's
how
a
much of a problem.
landslide.
And I wish I had the stats on me of like blown fourth quarter leads this season, because the Suns have built up multiple 20-point leads and just flush it away. Even against the actually against the Nuggets, I think they were the ones who made the comeback.
Yeah.
Or no, other way around. The Nuggets did make the comeback, but Phoenix staved them off in overtime,
Yeah, exactly.
which they outplayed Denver pretty badly. But besides that, you know, been one of the worst clutch time teams
Which
in
doesn't
the
make
NBA.
sense. Like you said, they have three bona fide like scorers, certified killers when it comes to crunch time, and they just can't convert.
And their role players aren't helping them. Royce O'Neal tonight was 0 for 7 from the field and 0 for 5 from 3. You know, if you're not going to get any help, you know, KD ran out of gas during the second quarter, which coincided with the game getting out of hand, even though less than a week ago, KD had 43 points on just 25 shots.
Ridiculous.
So it's unfortunate for the Suns. I think it's why they're going to have a really hard time competing. You know, even with a team perhaps with less experience like the Oklahoma City Thunder or the Minnesota Timberwolves, I just think that inability to close out games is going to hurt them.
Yeah, no, for sure. As of how it's standing right now, they're not going to get out of the first round. However, you never know. The playoffs come around like Playoff Jimmy gets born, like a lot of different people just like leave their shells and become different players. So you never really know, but as it
I
stands
mean,
right now,
the
for
Dallas
sure.
Mavericks as an 8 seed beat the 1 seed of Warriors. Or no, wait, the other way around. But the Dallas Mavericks as an 8 seed
They made the
had a crazy
conference finals, yeah,
finals.
in 21.
What seed were they when they won the finals in 2011?
I have no idea. Dirk.
Remember, but they were a pretty low seed if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I have no idea.
But it, you know, the playoffs are always kind of the stomping grounds for the underdogs. You know, examples, of course, like last year's Miami Heat, who lost a game in the play-in tournament before taking down the mighty Boston Celtics at home in a game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals. Or even a team like the Milwaukee Bucks rising above after so many playoff disappointments to win their first in 50 years. You know, it's
They were
I
the
feel
third
like
seed.
that's a fun it's a their third seed. Okay, higher than I remember, but that's kind of the fun thing about the playoffs. You never know what's going to happen. And I also feel like the NBA isn't always, at least not in the last like 5 years or so, been conducive to one seeds, even making the finals necessarily.
Yeah,
Your
no.
Raptors were not a one seed, for example, when they won the finals.
The Heat were the eighth seed when they made the finals, so.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and
it's not conclusive at all. It's not really correlated, but it definitely helps in terms of home court advantage. Like you look at the standings this time around and like you see the better teams at home, like the Denver Nuggets, for example, 27-6, the Thunder 26-7, but then on the road they're 19-14, 19-13. So like there's a huge difference when it comes to game 7 being at home or not. So like that's what the main reason behind teams like fighting so hard to get like a top 4 seed right now. But yeah, that's probably like not gonna happen with the teams we mentioned. Unfortunately, it's the end of an era and all that depressing stuff. But I guess keeping on this depressing note, the injuries in the NBA have been getting out of control, and you can tell because the type of play has like heightened tenfold post All-Star break because of these seeding implications we were mentioning. So you have players like Karl-Anthony Towns, Steph Curry, Donovan Mitchell, Tyrese Maxey, Rudy Gobert, Devin Booker, Alperen Şengün, Victor
We'll
Wembanyama,
mention with
Russell
Şengün, he
Westbrook.
avoided a lot more serious of an injury than it looked live. I was worried he
Yeah,
was
he
done
got
for the
pulled out on
season.
a wheelchair for sure, for sure. You got Benedict
Continue.
Mathurin, Evan Mobley. All of these players are out because, and more recently, Luka Doncic. You know, like it's just ridiculous how hard these players are playing because they want to give it and leave it out on the court. However, it's not materializing to what they want to be because they're often like one of their top players on their team. So once they try that little bit extra hard, obviously it goes without saying you're not supposed to not try your hardest. However, at the end of the day, you just got to be calculated, careful. Like LeBron's still out there. Like they showed his dunk in slow-mo and he looked 40 years old when he was dunking, man. Like he was jumping off 2 feet and he like barely got up there. He had to stretch his hands all the way up to get the dunk. Like the him like dunking in slow motion shows his age. It's ridiculous. Like you can see his forehead wrinkles like when he's like to like want a mean mug when he comes down. Like It's just like insane. Like you can still be careful and play well. Like AD, for example, like the classic story of getting injured, he's relatively healthy for the entirety of the season. And it's worth mentioning also that Luka sitting out tonight won't affect the fact that he might not win the scoring title because you need a minimum of 58 games for your stats to count as like in the top 10s but for all the major stats. So he finished his 58th game last game round. So he will officially win the scoring title this year. However, when it comes to all NBA awards and such, he needs like three or four more games. So we'll see if he meets that quota. Hopefully he will because I think he's a deadlock at first team all NBA, just like he has been a perennial first team all NBA type player. And I kind of also want to talk about how your Celtics have lost twice in their most recent road trip, or once in the road trip and then once before it. Those games had like a hell of a playoff feel, if you ask me. And offline, I remember us chatting about how it's a disadvantage that the Boston Celtics are in the Eastern Conference because they don't have to deal with the woes of the West. So, it's kind of tough for them to match up against a team that has three 6'10" starting players in their front court, and then one of those players being the best player in the league. So, what do you have to say about blowing a 22-point lead to the Cavs and then essentially just getting Dean waited in the fourth quarter?
Dean Wade.
And then,
Dude, it was so funny because a few of the commentators, they just kept saying D Wade, like
yeah,
Dwayne
like,
Wade. And even StatMuse put up a graphic that was clearly an outline of Dwayne Wade and not Dean Wade. Maybe it was being ironic, but like a lot of people were just
24th
like,
quarter
who?
points.
24, yeah, 23 points on the game, 24th quarter points where he was 6 or 7
That's
from three, I believe.
ridiculous.
And then had that like last minute second put back that put the Cavs
My
up 105
God.
to 104. I mean, it was a crazy game because the Celtics looked like they were just gonna run away with it. It was like 8 minutes left. You know, Tatum had 22 first half points, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was 105 to 104. Looked like Tatum might have gotten fouled. He didn't take the greatest middie to end it.
He wasn't
Porzingis might have
touched.
put Porzingis.
They reviewed that, and Garland didn't
Yeah,
touch
and
him.
Porzingis almost would have had a putback. Like the putback
Yeah,
went
but it
in,
was
but
expired.
it was a well, it was a foul, or they called
Oh,
the
I thought
foul,
the
but they
time had
returned
gone
it.
up.
Although if you look at the replay, he probably would have gotten it off late, unlike Derek White in the playoffs last year.
Oof, that was legendary.
I think the Denver one, I agree with you, is the most compelling because, you know, that is very much potentially a finals matchup we could see this year. Particularly since the Nuggets are, I think, have the most experience and are obviously the defending champs, so they should be viewed as the favorite out west. And the Celtics are just running away with the East, so they have like a 9.5 game advantage over the Milwaukee Bucks, and we're the first team in the NBA to clinch a playoff spot officially with their 52nd win tonight. But it is very interesting because on one hand, you look at the Celtics have the top offense by quite a bit, and historically high offensive rating at 121.9 per 100 possessions, which could end up being an NBA record. You know, we could do a full episode separately about, you know, just the insane rise in offensive efficiency, even
Oh,
from
yeah.
the Splash Bros dynasty of like 7, 8 years ago.
No, dude, 10 years ago, the highest offensive rating was like 100 points a game. Now it's like 123, and you guys are on pace to finish this season with the best offensive rated season of all time.
And Larry, like even 2 years ago, or excuse me, 2 years ago, back when the Celtics lost one title, their defensive rating was less than 1 point per possession, or less than 100 points per 100 possessions.
Yeah,
Now it's the
it's like in the
Timberwolves are like
90s.
108.
Yeah, in the
It was
90s.
like
Yeah.
98 for the Celtics that won, and you know, 108 now for the Timberwolves. I think that's gonna be the challenge for the Celtics, really. And to credit Brad Stevens, he's been sitting Porzingis out for a bit, probably to keep him healthy for the playoffs and to avoid adding him to that injury list. I think the Western Conference teams definitely could be Boston's biggest challenge, particularly the Nuggets, where they also have two stars, superstars, I would say, Jamal Murray and of course two-time MVP Nikola Jokic. So I think the it's just very interesting the imbalance between the East and the West this year. And I definitely agree that whoever makes it out of the East, as a Celtics fan, I want to say it's the Celtics, but just whoever makes it out of the East, they're going to have a really hard time with pretty much anyone they play with. Because any of those top four seeds out West could be really challenging later in the playoffs or in a finals matchup.
Well, with the outlier of the Bucks, most of the champions in the last like 10 years, Bucks and Cavs out of the equation have been the Western Conference. It's just known to be like the better conference. There's more to play for over there. And then like throughout the season, like remember when we were chatting offline that we were talking about like you're just more seasoned because throughout the season in the Western Conference, you're playing a lot tougher matchups. You know, like the star-studded rosters across the Western Conference just posed harder, difficult, more difficult matchups across every regular season game. So like by the time you come to face a team like the Boston Celtics, it's not that like new for you. Obviously, like the Celtics on paper are better than every team in the West. However, like just going through a season that's that demanding will kind of season you to get to the point where you're by the time you're in the finals, you don't care who you're playing because you know that you deserve it. In Denver's case, for example, you're the defending champs, you've been there before, and like we can review like the clutch time stats specifically within the last couple of minutes of every game. Denver amplifies the way they play because they have go-to set plays that they rely on that are very high percentage looks. For example, when the game slows down, they'll go back to their two-man game with Murray and Jokic. However, they won't take what the defense gives them. That's not to say that they don't, obviously, but what I'm trying to say is that they have very set plays that they're gonna go to. Where, for example, instead of like settling for a Jamal Murray mid-range bucket, which is usually cash, Jokic is gonna back Porzingis down and isolate him on the wing, and then Gordon's gonna cut from the weak side to get that lob. You know, I think half of or 45% of Jokic's assists this entire season have been to Aaron Gordon. And Jokic is so talented in passing that he doesn't have to look towards where you are. He just knows that you're there by initially glancing at the fact that you're running to that corner. And then he can keep his eyes on the right side of the court for the entirety of that possession. And then when he sees that help defender come from the left corner, he'll pass it to the left without even looking there. And that's what you literally can't do anything because as one of the best defenders in the NBA and like Jrue Holiday, for example, what do a lot of other good players come out and say about him? Is that he anticipates what you're going to do really well. That's why he's defending it because on top of the fact that he enjoys playing defense and he's good at it, he is really good at anticipating what you're going to do by reading your face and reading your moves and just knowing what you like to go for, like knowing your tendencies and what you like to do as a player. So like once Nikola Jokic goes up the floor and he knows that, like, for example, let's say KCP is on the left corner. He knows that KCP is being guarded by whoever is guarding him. So like when he backs down Porzingis or whoever on the post, and he sees that weak side help defender come to double because Porzingis was giving Jokic anything he wanted in the paint. He's gonna automatically swing it out to that left side of the corner without even looking there once that entire possession. And that's what makes their clutch time offense out off the walls. And like Jamal Murray has been interviewed and came out saying that they feel they play better when the game is on the line under 5 minutes in that clutch situation. And that can be proved furthermore in the Western Conference Finals last season. The Lakers against the Warriors, the four games, it was a clean sweep, but the four games that ended were less than 10 points on the points differential spectrum across all four games aggregated. So the Denver Nuggets literally won the series by a total of less than 10 points. Like, let that sink in and see how insane of a stat that is. And that's why I think they ultimately have the nod or they're still deemed the favorites when it comes to a potential Boston or Philly, I don't know with Joel Embiid if he comes back, or like the Heat, whoever comes out of the East, I think Denver Nuggets just has a more reliable go-to scheme when it comes to these clutch time situations, because A, their game is amplified because of their experience. B, they have these set plays that they rely on that give them an insanely high percentage shot. Like we're talking about how, for example, Jrue Holiday from the corner, he's shooting 65% this season. So like that's literally one of the best, because like if you shoot 60% from the mid-range, that's considered shooting 40% from three. So imagine shooting 60 freaking percent from three as a best, and you're not even an offensive player, you're a freaking defensive player. So like that's as high percentage of a shot that you're gonna get, but it's still not better than an Aaron Gordon lob, because Aaron Gordon is probably 99% on his lobs this season. You can see that because Jamal Murray against the Celtics passed him a lob off the glass and he still sinked that. So at the end of the day, you guys, as in the Boston Celtics, you have an amazing historic all-time roster, all-time offensive rating, all-time everything. However, when it comes to clutch situations, you're not posting up Porzingis and having Jaylen Brown cut from the back. You're going to give it to Jason Tatum and he's going to settle for a three, or he's going to settle for like a post fade from the mid-range, or you're going to give it to Jaylen Brown, he's going to dribble left and he's going to lose the ball. Or you're going to give it to KP and instead of posting up, he's going to shoot up a three. And that's essentially what's going to knock you guys down in the finals, in my opinion. Because the Denver Nuggets, when it comes to clutch times, have such a relied upon and consistent scheme that they go back on. And it's just innate to them at this point that they don't even have to think about it. And they start off with their two-man game, which is already unguardable and essentially basically on the Boston Celtics offensive level. So like they're not even settling for shots that are on an all-time historic offensive level scale. They're getting the shot that they know for sure is going to go in. They'd rather pass up a wide open MPJ corner three, which is arguably on the same level as Jrue Holiday's corner threes, because Michael Porter Jr. is an insane shot maker and you can't contest him because his release point is so high at 6'10". So they'd rather pass up shots like this, or like I said, a Jamal Murray post up, which he's probably shooting like 57% plus from the mid range. They're gonna pass all these shots up and they're gonna rely on that back door from Aaron Gordon, and the best passer in the world is gonna give it to him. And the dunk contest champion is going to dunk it down and he's going to run away with the game, because that's how they rely on their offense. It's simply unguardable, because you just can't, like, you're not going to not help off of Nikola Jokic backing down Porzingis, because he's been getting the best of him all game. So you're just not going to not help, because he's going to score. So like when you do help, you're gonna even give up a higher percentage look, because you just, as a player, you just can't like sit down and watch Porzingis get bullied time and time and time and time again. So if you're Jaylen Brown guarding Aaron Gordon, you're gonna come up and you're gonna try to strip Jokic, and then Jokic is gonna see you come up and he's gonna know in his head without looking that Aaron Gordon's cutting back door, and he's gonna give him a free lob. He's gonna put them up by two. And then they're going to rely on their defense, which is by no means even comparable to Boston's. However, in clutch game situations, their rotations get up to par with what like a Sacramento Kings defense might be, for example. They're not going to give out open shots. They're not going to give you easy dunks. They're going to make you rely on what is your guys' demise in the Boston Celtics, which is a Tatum ISO, for example, or a Porzingis three, or a Jaylen Brown ISO losing the ball. Or like it's just not gonna be what your typical offensive scheme's gonna look like, because they're gonna push you so much to the corner that you guys just are gonna crack, in my opinion.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, two games. I agree with everything you said, first of all. Like, I think the Celtics, although they are one of the better clutch teams in the league in terms of both their win-loss record, as well as their shooting, it's definitely going to be a little bit of a struggle figuring out how to stop
Close
those Aaron
games.
Gordon backdoor cuts. And one thing even though they do have the second best defensive rating, one thing that I see just from an eye test as I watch the games, and this was a huge problem for them in their Cleveland game, they either weren't rotating fast enough or they were just completely failing to make their switches. And if the Nuggets are gonna move quick and kind of, and Jokic's brain's gonna move quick, the Celtics defense, they can't be slacking on, those rotations or kind of giving up a lane for Gordon to use for the lob. So I think it's definitely a huge concern. I think it'll mostly come down to what do the Celtics put together, does their offense at some point tire out Denver's defense, or maybe can they force some more turnovers? Maybe that's the only possible concern for Denver. Like, what if Jokic just isn't making anything, which is very rare, but you still have those games. Same thing with Murray.
For
Like,
sure, for
it
sure.
was weird. Denver made the gentleman sleep, but Murray had like a six turnover and seven turnover game. And when you're playing a more talented team, those margins can also make a difference, especially if you're, either perceived or statistically or however you want to view it, the less talented team. I think that could be Denver's challenge. However, I will say they absolutely have the advantage in terms of their clutch time situations, their situational basketball, which I think is something the Celtics really need to improve. It's maybe the one thing I want to see Joe Mazzulla work on as a coach. It's really figuring out, the Nuggets defense knows that they're going to do one of the three situations you mentioned, the most likely being, I would say, a Tatum like ISO, like mid-range, possibly
Fade
a
away.
pull-up three. But super predictable. And
Yeah.
it's not interesting. You're not posting up Porzingis. You're not, depends on how much time you have left on the clock. You're not facilitating through Jrue Holiday or, Derek White, who we'll talk about later in this episode. Like, he has his not so great shooting streaks. Was 1-for-14
Streaky.
from three for a little bit, but then went 7-for-11 immediately after. So he's someone that can get you big buckets. And if you want to talk about one thing the 2022 Celtics did not have, they obviously got Derek White that February, but he hadn't really figured out how to be like kind of a spot up shooter. Didn't have his th the three ball that he has now. So that could be an interesting element for the Celtics and definitely different from even last year, but 2 years ago especially. But I think that Denver versus Boston game was incredibly compelling. I mean, hats off to the Nuggets. I do think they should actually be the favorites in spite of Boston possibly being the more talented team. And of course, if the income, the defending champs are playing high level basketball, I feel like they almost inherently should be the favorites heading into the following year, let alone with 15 games left in the season.
Yeah, man, I just think when it comes to late game execution, they have that like way better than any other team in the league. However, you said it better, like when it comes to a pure talent on paper perspective, you guys have the better players. However, I think when it comes to like a in unison collective late game executional aspect, they just have that like tied down so much better than any other team. And that's what makes them winners. That's what made them beat the Lakers in a 7-game series by a margin of less than 10 collective points. But yeah, we spent enough time talking about that. I kind of want to move on to how it's worth mentioning that the Knicks versus Philadelphia had the lowest combined score of 152. Neither team hit 80 points each since 2016. So they both ended with under 80. Philly? No, the Knicks won that game.
The Knicks did win that game.
The Knicks won that game 79-73. And then you also had Tobias Harris the game after 2 points versus New York when they played them again right after that game we just mentioned. 2 points. He's getting paid $39 million a season. That's good for, I
That's
think, fifth or
absurd.
sixth in the entire league. And he's not even the third option on his own team.
And here's the thing that's so crazy. To be totally fair to Embiid, yes, you can make the arguments that like he scores 10 fewer points per game in the playoffs versus the regular season, but he has not gotten help by Philly's front office in the slightest. One of the worst moves, and this has been infamously referenced 2 years ago in the playoffs, after the Miami Heat took down the Philadelphia 76ers, and Jimmy Butler on the way back to the locker room infamously said, "King Tobias Harris over me, Tobias Harris over me." On one hand, it was just Jimmy being, his normal goofball self, but on the other hand, he's 100% correct. Jimmy Butler really made the 76ers a tough team, added dimension to the team both on offense and defense, hard-nosed player, and they got rid of him and instead decided to pay Tobias Harris with the hopes of satisfying Ben Simmons, and that's got to be one of the worst decisions ever. And as you mentioned, they gave Tobias Harris a massive $39 million contract, all for him to just be a non-factor, if not just a flat-out net negative, both in the regular season and the playoffs.
Yeah, it's sad, which is the opposite of what Cleveland's been doing with their stars out. And that's worth mentioning because they've kind of been seesawing their last few games. However, that's still good for second seed in the entire West. And those seesaws come with notable wins against the Timberwolves, against your Celtics, against the Mavs. They've been winning against really good teams. They beat the Kings, they beat the Clippers, they beat the Bucks. So like you got that like Twin Tower lineup in Mobley and Allen, and then you have Darius Garland with Mitchell being out, coming back to his all-star self. He's been shooting at a 40% clip across his last 15 games from three, which is one of the massive outliers he's had this season. He started out the season shooting like 33, 34%, which is super non-Garland like. So that was sad because he's one of my favorite players as well. He's super shifty with the ball, and he views himself as a true point guard, which was kind of outlined in their most recent win as well against the Pelicans. He actually had 11 assists on one turnover. So that's worth mentioning how Garland went crazy, dropped 27 points off 16 shots, only 1 for 1 from the free throw line. So it was a very genuine 27 points, no free throw merchant style type Embiid craft, witchcraft, whatever you want to call it. And this is against a red hot New Orleans team, which we mentioned in the beginning of this episode. So it's lovely for me to see one of my favorite guards in Darius Garland pick up his 3-point percent all the way from like 34 to 39 in the season. He still has a few games left. He can go up to 40 if he continues playing the way he is. As I mentioned in that game, he went 6 for 10 from three, which is good for 60%. You have him dishing out lots of assists, which is not shown in his assists per game average of 6.5, because he plays next to Donovan Mitchell a lot, and he sat out for a good chunk of the season, so he only played half of the regular season games. So if he played in a lot more, I think those stats would be amplified. But yeah, it's just worth mentioning how he's been one of like the Cleveland Cavaliers diamonds in the rough alongside Jared Allen. He's also been playing like his previous all-star self. If you go back and see his game against the Minnesota Timberwolves, he actually dropped 33 points, 18 rebounds, 3 assists, only on 20 shots. He went 15 for 21 from the field, which is good for an insane efficiency of 71%. So, and sorry, that's not from the field, that's from the free throw line, which is actually insane for a 7-footer that can't shoot. So he went 9 for 19 from the field, which is when you're being guarded by Gobert, if you're going 47% from the field as the big, that's commendable. It's Rudy Gobert, right? So like, but shooting 15 for 21 from the free throw line as a big is absolutely ridiculous. So I just wanted to shout out Jared Allen for that, because they're playing with bums and George Niang. That's pretty much the one bum they're playing with, honestly. Caris LeVert's pretty good.
And even
Cora's been
Niang, he
holding
can
his weight.
sometimes just pop off with like the most absurd
Yeah, but he's
stat
shooting like
lines.
36% as like a catch and shoot spot up. Like, come on, man. Like, he's not even that
Well,
good
yeah, it's because he follows
defensively.
up like a 6 for 8 or 7 for 8 from three game with like an 0 for 8 game.
Yeah,
So that
exactly.
makes a lot of sense.
I mean, that's probably due to good defense, which is a perfect segue to our last segment. We saved the best for last. We're essentially just
Nice.
gonna highlight our all defensive picks, and then going into the next few episodes, we're gonna highlight like the MVP, MIP, and all that good stuff. So it's worth mentioning once again for all our listeners out there that don't know or forgot that the NBA implemented a 65 game rule in which you have to play at least 20, or you can't miss more than 20% of the total NBA games. So there's some fine print in there saying like if you got injured as a season-ending injury at your 62nd game out of your 82 total games, that you are essentially good for being picked on one of those teams. You do qualify. However, if the regular rule states that you have to at least have 65 games played with 20 minutes or more logged on to each game under your belt for one season to qualify for the NBA's awards. So that off the dot gives you a lot of notable misses that would have made it without question, like OG Anunoby, Kristaps Porzingis, Jimmy Butler. So you have those three players in specific that would have made this first or second all defensive teams by a landslide if they didn't miss the per game quota. So that gives a lot of other up and coming defenders a lot more limelight to step in to make those all defensive teams, which is also worth mentioning more specifically for the regular all NBA teams. If players miss that 65 game stretch, then they're going to miss out on that potential supermax that qualifies you for them, as we saw in the most recent example with Jaylen Brown. And that's going to create a very strong shift of tides in the league today, because you're going to get a lot less players who don't necessarily deserve the same contracts that are going to be qualifying for them. That's going to create a lot of points of contention for those teams to see if they're going to pay them if they do qualify or not. Because in this day and age, if you qualify, that essentially means you're owed that money because you're going to go and find it somewhere else in the league. So yeah, without further ado, we mentioned our notable misses that don't qualify. Other notable misses that just simply didn't make the cut that do qualify include, and I don't know if I want to include this name, but Jrue Holiday. As I mentioned, as I
Goated
want to mention,
perimeter defender, though.
yeah, I mean, I kind of want to give him the nod over Jalen Suggs on the second team. So like that'll I'll leave that for you to kind of like end off the episode with. Other good defenders are Kawhi Leonard, PG, Paul George, Luol Dort. They didn't make the cut, unfortunately. So and Connor's first and second team all defense. So we'll start out with the first team. We got Derek White, which is like essentially a big in a guard's body with his blocks and perimeter defense. We got Herb Jones on the Pelicans, who's literally like been the defensive anchor for them, which is giving them the net rating that we talked about, the sixth best defense in the entire league, the second best net rating in March, all that good stuff. We got Jalen McDaniels, which is single-handedly responsible alongside Rudy Gobert with the best defense in the entire NBA for the Minnesota Timberwolves. And then at the four position, we have yours truly, Anthony Davis, which is pretty much a unicorn like Wembanyama when it comes to his defense. We mentioned how he almost had a 5-by-5 game, but was only short with two extra blocks that he missed, which he actually had in the third quarter. So he had a quarter and a half to get two blocks, and he didn't. So that sucks. And then so the second team, we'll start out with Alex Caruso. He's been one of the main reasons the Chicago Bulls are making a late game or late season push into the play-in, where everyone thought they'd be like a 10th to 13th seed. And then also, I have to mention DeMar DeRozan's heroics. He dropped 43 against the Pacers the other day, made that game single-handedly go into OT with the announcers for the Pacers saying, no, guard him. And then the Bulls announcers going crazy. That was fun for anyone who didn't see it. I recommend looking up that final shot on YouTube. And then the point of contention, Jrue Holiday or Jalen Suggs, not sure. That I think Jalen Suggs is like up and coming, whereas Jrue Holiday is much more established. So that's up for you to decide. And then our front court encompasses Bam Adebayo, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Victor Wembanyama for all defensive second team.
Yeah, I mean, first team, I'm in complete agreement with you. We talked about Herb Jones earlier in this episode, anchoring one of the best defenses in the league, one of the most improved defenses too, in which he's really been a leader of that unit. You have Rudy Gobert, Jalen McDaniels leading far and away the best defense in this league. Gobert's always been one of the best bigs, was an anchor for their defense in Utah, why they were good for so many years.
Two-time DPOY.
And AD, or excuse me, AD, of course, had that crazy game against Minnesota a few nights back. Had how many blocks they have in that game? Steals. It was like 5 and 7 or something.
Yeah, 10 stocks.
Yeah, he did.
Seven
Oh,
steals.
five.
Yeah, three blocks.
It was 3 and 7. Okay, so he did get the 10 stocks, which is just crazy. Also can get you like that 15, 20 boards a game. And obviously, guy I want to give the most flowers to, Derek White's. Really just been absolute menace on the around the glass, really defending the inside, the paint really well. He's been one of the staples of the Celtics defense since coming to the team 2 Februaries ago. As for the second team, Caruso, great. Bam, Giannis, Wemby, I all agree with those. Wemby's been amazing rookie. I would take Jrue Holiday over Jalen Suggs, but Jalen Suggs has led one of the best defenses and one of the youngest defenses in the NBA in the Orlando Magic.
Yeah, no, we'll see when they come out. And yeah, I think he should be over Jrue Holiday.